bank. One of Rockefeller's financial advisors, Henry E. Cooper, indignantly told him, "You ought to get after him hard." "No, Mr. Cooper, we will do nothing," said Rockefeller evenly, "but we shall not forget it." In November 1887, as he listened to Rockefeller testify before the new Interstate Commerce Commission, Henry Demarest Lloyd saw the witness as the Prince of Darkness, evil incarnate. Afterward, he furiously scribbled notes that he headed "Fanatic Standard Oil," and had this to say about Rockefeller. "He is a depredator, not a worshipper of liberty, a czar of plutocracy, a worshipper of his own money power over mankind. He will never sacrifice any of his plans for the restraints of law or patriotism or philanthropy. His greed, rapacity, flow as a universal solvent wherever they can, melting down into gold for him, private enterprise, public morals, judicial honor, legislative faith, gifts of nature. He will stop when he is stopped, not before. Not a tiger, but a lynx. A make-up like that of the gentleman pirate of romance. Think cold, ruthless." Convinced that Standard Oil was the archetypal trust, Lloyd embarked on a book-length study 2 years later, and by the time Wealth Against Commonwealth appeared in 1894, he was sure that the public was ripe for his revelations. As he wrote on the eve of publication, "The sky seems full of signs that the time for the appearance of such information has come." Known as the Millionaire Socialist, the Natty Lloyd had longish hair, wire-rimmed spectacles, and a flowing mustache, which gave him a vaguely artistic air. Among his friends he included Clarence Darrow, Jane Addams, Eugene Debs, and Booker T. Washington. He was toasted by many literary figures, and Robert Louis Stevenson called him a "very capable, clever fellow," asserting that "he writes the most workmanlike article of any man known to me in America." A foppish reformer, Lloyd attended trade union meetings wearing pince-nez on a gold chain, a gray top hat, and glossily polished boots. When he supported anarchists blamed for the Haymarket Square riot in Chicago in 1886, his outraged father-in-law, a co-owner of the Chicago Tribune, disinherited him and placed his estate in trust for Lloyd's children. To maintain his existence as a dapper millionaire and literary troubadour for radical causes, Lloyd relied on his wife's income. Lloyd's politics became more radical over time. With a messianic outlook, he had promiscuous sympathy for every crusade. Starting out as a free market liberal, he then turned to socialism, trade unions, worker cooperatives, and utopian communities. He once referred to himself as a socialist, anarchist, communist, individualist, collectivist, cooperative, aristocratic democrat. And that was just for starters. Scarcely a cause in the progressive panoply, from attacking tariffs to favoring municipal ownership of utilities to combating sweatshops, escaped his wide-ranging vision. Like Karl Marx, he believed in the inevitable collapse of capitalism, which he thought corrupt and predatory. Also like Marx, he imagined that competition led to monopoly, a welcome step since it was a necessary and indubitable step toward national and international cooperation. Lloyd returned to Standard Oil, the subject of his 1881 story in the Atlantic Monthly, for several reasons. Dismayed by the failure of the Sherman Law to curb monopolies, he ridiculed it as the anti-trades union law, a mere ruse perpetrated by a worldwide concert of action of a money power, crazy with greed and fanatical to the hilt, to re-enslave the working people. He could also now draw upon a wide body of material churned up by government investigations against Standard Oil. Drawing on a small army of Rockefeller haters, including George Rice, Lewis Emery, and Roger Sherman, he gathered court records and trial transcripts, which he stuffed into pigeonholes at his home in Winnetka, outside Chicago. When one acquaintance visited him there, Lloyd told him, "I will prove that John D. Rockefeller is the most selfish usurper that ever lived." With Dostoevskian passion, he filled notebooks with flaming diatribes against the American plutocracy, describing the Rockefellers and Vanderbilts as members of a cruel, selfish, carnivorous, short-sighted herd. The lists of sensational titles he compiled for his Standard Oil book, including Slime in Genesis, Fountains of Pitch, and Barbarians of Business, said as much about his overheated imagination as they did about the trust. In fact, Lloyd spouted so much fustian that it made it easy for businessmen to dismiss him, despite his often accurate insights. Wealth Against Commonwealth had no kind words to spare for Standard Oil. Lloyd marshaled every wispy allegation made against the trust and printed it as gospel truth. Where Ida Tarbell later portrayed Rockefeller and his cohorts as superb, if immoral, businessmen, Lloyd presented them as brazen criminals who owed everything to diabolical deeds. Later on, speaking privately of the criminal character of the Standard Oil executives, he insisted that they ought to be in the penitentiary. Like his Atlantic Monthly piece, his book was chock-a-block with errors and egregious misrepresentations. For instance, he described the Rothschilds as Standard Oil's agents abroad. Accusing Rockefeller of rigging artificial shortages to drive up kerosene prices, Lloyd failed to see that the trust maintained its dominance by keeping prices low and selectively engaging in predatory pricing. He ennobled any businessman, however greedy or inept, who opposed Rockefeller. Yet for all its weaknesses, the book had a profound and lasting impact, and ranks as a classic of muckraking literature. Lloyd was a superb stylist, whose mellifluous prose captivated readers. Every paragraph was a call to arms. Whatever the holes in his argument, he gave a clear, intelligent shape to a complex story, especially when it came to the importance of railroad rebates in the rise of Standard Oil. When he argued that the South Improvement Company never died but became Rockefeller's master blueprint, he laid down a line of argument followed by Ida Tarbell. What also gave the book its force was Lloyd's political message. Liberty produces wealth, and wealth destroys liberty. As the trust's power rippled through society, he said, it corrupted every corner of American life. The noble experiment of American democracy was being undermined by businessmen who had grown more powerful than the state and controlled its elected representatives. Our system, so fair in its theory and so fertile in its happiness and prosperity in its first century, is now, following the fate of systems, becoming artificial, technical, corrupt. In Wealth Against Commonwealth, Lloyd omitted all names, even though Rockefeller, Flagler, and others were all too recognizable. Standard Oil was never mentioned and was usually referred to as the oil combination, or some other euphemism. This technique protected Lloyd from libel prosecution, though he fell back upon a highfalutin explanation for it. It seems of the highest importance that the book should retain its character of an illustration of the motives and results of our commercial civilization, not an attack on a particular corporation or body of men. Lloyd's manuscript found a publisher with difficulty. Mark Twain, who then had his own publishing venture, turned it down in deference to his close friendship with Henry H. Rogers. As Twain told his wife, "I wanted to say to Lloyd, the only man I care for in the world, the only man I would give a damn for, the only man who is lavishing his sweat and blood to save me and mine from starvation and shame, is a Standard Oil fiend. But I didn't say that. I said I didn't want any book. I wanted to get out of the publishing business." Luckily for Lloyd, he won the passionate sponsorship of another literary luminary, his former Atlantic Monthly editor William Dean Howells, who was bowled over by his indictment of Rockefeller. "I think that the monstrous iniquity whose story you tell so powerfully, accomplished itself in our time, is so astounding, so infuriating, that I have to stop from chapter to chapter and take breath." Howells steered Lloyd to Harper and Brothers, who agreed to issue the book if the author substantially condensed it, paid for publication, and guaranteed a sale of 1,500 copies. A deal only a rich radical could afford. Published in 1894, the book passed through four printings within a year and sold a respectable 8,000 copies in its first decade. Some sour notes were heard amid the praise. The Nation began its scathing review by saying, "This book is a notable example of the rhetorical blunder of overstatement," and it branded the book 500 pages of the wildest rant. Yet the work was praised widely by many reformers, including Louis Brandeis, and Edward Everett Hale called it the most important American book since Uncle Tom's Cabin. Since Lloyd distributed free copies to politicians, it became the Bible of Washington trustbusters. With his penchant for melodrama, Lloyd claimed he had been tailed by Standard Oil detectives and told friends that he expected to be crushed by the Standard people. He seemed half disappointed when 26 Broadway reacted to his book with stern silence. Although colleagues informed him of the book's accusations, Rockefeller did not read it and said Standard Oil paid no more attention to all this nonsense than an elephant might be expected to pay to a tiny mosquito. Rockefeller now declined almost weekly requests to sit for magazine profiles, including one from a new magazine being launched by Samuel S. McClure, who was then in Paris trying to sign up an obscure young writer from Pennsylvania, Ida Minerva Tarbell. Even after the publication of Wealth Against Commonwealth, Lloyd regaled friends with scurrilous gossip about Rockefeller, telling one correspondent with cynical relish that the mogul had recently gone abroad, ostensibly to recuperate from the strain of his charities. Sure that Rockefeller had left the country to divide up global oil markets with the Russians, Lloyd guffawed at reports that Rockefeller's health had broken down under the crushing weight of his beneficence. The wonder is that he expects people to believe that sort of thing, and that they do believe it, Lloyd told a friend. The irony, of course, is that Rockefeller spoke the unvarnished truth. Lloyd was always as blind to Rockefeller's virtues as he was sensitive to his glaring vices. By 1895, Rockefeller, age 56, had begun to fade by imperceptible degrees into retirement. That year, he sat for a haunting portrait by Eastman Johnson that was commissioned by the board of the University of Chicago and that shows him toward the close of his business career. Set against a dark backdrop, the Titan sits on a simple wooden chair, fixing the viewer with a fiery stare. His long, tapered fingers are delicately interlaced and his legs are urbanely crossed, but there is a blazing intensity, an inextinguishable fire in his eyes. Rockefeller still looks powerful and surprisingly youthful, but there is a sadness about him, as if he were stooped under a great weight and enveloped in unfathomable gloom. Since he dated his retirement as early as 1894 and as late as 1897, there is some uncertainty as to when Rockefeller officially left 26 Broadway, but 1895 and 1896 are the likely watershed years. Though he was still suffering from sporadic digestive problems and nervous strain, the 1893 panic had forced him to postpone his departure several times. In explaining his retirement, the Rockefeller literature has always stressed his health and the heavy burden of his charities, though another factor contributed as well. He had perfected the gleaming machinery of Standard Oil, and his appointed task done, he felt he should pass the reins to younger men. As Gates put it, the business had ceased to amuse him, it lacked freshness and variety, and had become merely irksome, and he withdrew. By 1896, Rockefeller was skipping the daily lunch meetings at 26 Broadway, and only occasionally exchanged memos with other executives. By June 4, 1896, he had already relinquished most of his duties, for he ended a letter to Archbold, "I shall be very pleased at any time to hear anything new that is important in the business, if it will not trouble you too much, or if you will kindly call Mr. Rogers." In September 1897, Rockefeller suffered another medical setback, apparently related to circulatory problems, and his doctors insisted that he promptly transfer more day-to-day decisions to his representatives. "I do not call myself sick," Rockefeller commented to one relative, "but this little warning I will promptly heed, as health is of the first importance." So in 1897, the year his son graduated from Brown, Rockefeller walked away from the empire that had consumed his energies for more than 30 years, and during the next 15 years he scarcely appeared at 26 Broadway. He was succeeded by John D. Archbold, his jovial, pugnacious protégé, who gave a more defiant and combative tone to the trust in its duels with government investigators, committing a public relations blunder of no small magnitude. In a grave misstep, Rockefeller never publicly announced his retirement and retained the titular presidency of Standard Oil of New Jersey. As a result, he remained an inviting target for critics and was personally held liable for many of the questionable judgments made by Archbold, who was nominally vice president of New Jersey Standard. In our age of an assertive business press, when corporate secrets are readily ferreted out by reporters, it is scarcely conceivable that the world's richest man running the world's largest business could have drifted away from business without public knowledge. Yet much of the press, to Rockefeller's later chagrin, swallowed the cover story whole. While some reporters knew that he no longer reported to work, they doubted that he had really surrendered supervisory power. The misconception was understandable. He owned nearly 30% of Standard Oil stock, far more than anyone else, and did not hesitate to proffer advice as the urge seized him. Small groups of company lawyers and executives periodically briefed him, and Archbold made regular weekend pilgrimages to consult him at his Westchester estate. As trustbusters took dead aim at the company, Rockefeller was driven to develop a common defense with current executives, pulling him back into the past even as he tried to move on to new pursuits. Rockefeller entered retirement just at the birth of the American automobile industry. As he noted, "When I retired from business, we had just begun to hope that someday autos would be practical." That year, Frank and Charles Duryea produced 13 two-cylinder runabouts in Springfield, Massachusetts, the first time a car company had produced several cars from a standardized model. And Henry Ford put the finishing touches to the quadricycle, his first horseless carriage. The automobile would make John D. Rockefeller far richer in retirement than at work. When he stepped down from Standard Oil, he was probably worth about $200 million, $3.5 billion today, whereas, thanks to the internal combustion engine, his fortune soared to $1 billion by 1913. Surely history's most lucrative retirement, and one that must have softened the sting of press vituperation. In 1897, Joseph Pulitzer's World showcased John D. Rockefeller and Henry M. Flagler as two of the five chief overlords of the Standard Oil Trust, yet Flagler had now ranged even farther afield than Rockefeller. A man with many cronies but few close friends, Rockefeller reserved warm praise for Flagler. "You and I have been associated in business upwards of 35 years," Rockefeller wrote to him in 1902, "and while there have been times when we have not agreed on questions of policy, I do not know that one unkind word has ever passed or unkind thought existed between us. I feel that my pecuniary success is due to my association with you. If I have contributed anything to yours, I am thankful." Flagler repaid the compliment, telling one Baptist preacher that if he would spend the remainder of his life in praising Mr. Rockefeller, he could not say too much nor more than was actually deserved. But these high-flown touching tributes masked a certain froideur that had crept into their relationship as they neared retirement. Although Rockefeller never said so outright, one senses that he thought Flagler had become a slave to fashion and ostentation, a traitor to the austere puritanical creed that had united them. Though his hair and mustache were now dusted with gray, Flagler had a lean, handsome face and was highly susceptible to female charm. He had suffered many personal misfortunes in marriage and exercised woefully bad judgment. His consumptive first wife, Mary, had become a professional invalid. When doctors recommended an extended winter stay for her in 1878, Henry joined her in Florida, but itching to get back to Standard Oil, he bolted for New York after a few weeks. Unwilling to stay alone, Mary followed him back instead of taking time to recuperate properly. When she died in May 1881, Henry felt profoundly guilty. At that point, he took stock of his life and decided he had sacrificed too much to business, telling one reporter, "I have been giving all my days to the Lord hitherto, and now I'm taking one for myself." During the winter of 1882 to 1883, he was hospitalized with a liver ailment and began to pore over newspaper articles about Florida land deals. In 1883, at age 53, Flagler married Ida Alice Shords, 35, a former actress who had nursed Mary during her illness. A short woman with red hair, electric blue eyes, and an incendiary temper, Ida Alice seemed determined to run through Flagler's money, gathering an expensive wardrobe and trying to buy her way into New York high society. Whatever his reservations about the match, Rockefeller visited Henry and Ida Alice on their honeymoon in St. Augustine, Florida, during the winter of 1883 to 1884. No less prophetic in his business hunches than at Standard Oil, Flagler had faith that Florida would someday be converted from a pestilential, mosquito-ridden jungle into a place of wonder, recreation, and exotic beauty. The next winter, when the Rockefellers and Flaglers again traveled to St. Augustine, Henry bought several acres of orange grove as the site for the future Ponce de Leon Hotel. To cater to a less affluent clientele, he added the Alcazar Hotel across the street, its facade patterned after the Alcazar Palace of Seville. As the resident railroad expert of Standard Oil, Flagler saw that Florida's development had been retarded by inadequate transport. And in the late 1880s, he bought two railroads that opened for settlement a coastal stretch around Ormond and Daytona beaches. Buying a large hotel on the Halifax River, he remodeled it, grafted on an 18-hole golf course, and renamed it the Ormond Beach Hotel. Years later, John D. Rockefeller's winter home, the Casements, stood directly across the street. Driven by his faith in Florida's future, Flagler merged his railroads in 1892 and conceived a master plan for a railroad that would snake down the length of Florida's Atlantic coast to Key West, with Flagler Resorts dotting the route, a vision he realized in 1912. Each time Flagler pushed the railway farther south, it opened more swamp to development, triggering another land boom. As always, when infected with development fever, Flagler ran up bills that taxed even his massive fortune. In 1890, he sold 2,500 shares of Standard Oil stock to Rockefeller for $375,000 and made further stock sales to him for several years, right on the verge of the auto boom that would send those shares soaring. Rockefeller followed Flagler's business adventures in Florida with sympathy, but at a distance. "Henry did a great job in Florida," he said. "Think of pouring out all that money on a whim." But then Henry was always bold. Yet he turned a deaf ear to his friend's repeated entreaties to visit again. "I believe this country would be a revelation to you if you would take a week to look into it," Flagler pleaded with him in 1889. Yet Rockefeller still stayed away from the state after his 1884 to 1885 visit. "It is marvelous what Mr. Flagler has wrought in that southern country," Rockefeller told William Rainey Harper in 1898, "and I regret not to have paid him a visit long ago." Why this sudden distance in so singular a friendship? When they did see each other, Rockefeller and Flagler were always nostalgic, yet they seldom contrived to meet. One suspects that John and Setty were scandalized by the showy airs and sybaritic indulgence of Ida Alice Flagler. Bowing to his second wife, Henry had bought a private railroad car and a 160-foot yacht, both tellingly named the Alicia, and the Flaglers behaved more and more like the gaudy arrivistes the Rockefellers abhorred. Then Ida Alice began to show incipient signs of mental illness that overtook her in later years. Out of the blue, she began to chatter about her husband's adultery, a real enough situation, but one magnified in Ida Alice's fevered mind. In 1891, Henry became infatuated with Mary Lily Kennan, a beautiful, gifted 24-year-old from a prominent North Carolina family, who offered him respite from his moody, unstable wife, and Ida Alice became pathologically obsessed with this relationship. During the summer of 1893, Ida Alice's manic behavior worsened when she obtained a Ouija board. Closeted in her room, she spent hours communing with astral spirits, convinced the Tsar of Russia had fallen madly in love with her. When she threatened to kill Flagler in October 1895 and accused him of trying to poison her, she was committed to a sanatorium in Pleasantville, New York. In the spring of 1896, after the doctors declared Ida Alice cured, she returned to live with Henry at their large estate, Satan's Toe, in Mamaroneck, New York. For a few happy weeks, they rode bikes together and read aloud to each other, suggesting a tenuous return to happier times. Then Ida Alice bribed a servant to smuggle in a Ouija board and promptly succumbed to old demons. Once back at the board, she relapsed into her paranoid dream world. When she flew at one doctor, wielding a pair of scissors, she was returned to the Pleasantville Sanatorium in March 1897. There she renamed herself Princess Ida Alice von Schottentech and never saw Henry again. After the courts ruled Ida Alice Flagler insane in 1899, Henry set up a trust fund for her, stocked with $2 million in Standard Oil shares, which would appreciate to more than $15 million by her death in July 1930. Henry, meanwhile, was in a bind. New York state law would not permit divorce on grounds other than adultery, and he could not prove adultery against a woman confined to an asylum. Never deterred by restrictive laws, Flagler switched his legal residence to Florida and applied his influence with state legislators. On April 9, 1901, a special law was enacted permitting divorce on grounds of incurable insanity, a law known as the Flagler Divorce Law. Within 2 weeks, Flagler married Mary Lily Kennan. The wedding was performed in high style, Flagler bringing friends down from New York in a private railroad car, but Rockefeller did not attend. He must have felt Flagler was making a spectacle of himself, especially when he was named correspondent in a divorce suit in Syracuse, New York, 1 month after his marriage. That the Rockefellers had drifted away from Flagler is suggested by a note Setti wrote her son in August 1900. We have the announcement of Mr. Flagler's marriage to a Miss Kennan of North Carolina. She is 36, he 72. Setti expresses no pleasure at the marriage, but only cites, with implicit disapproval, the difference in age. Mary Kennan was actually 33 at the time. Chapter 19. The Dauphin. When he entered college in 1893, John D. Rockefeller Jr. seemed like the prototype of the poor little rich boy, stuck with an overdeveloped conscience and the badge of being the son of one of the world's wealthiest men. Having had a rather solitary childhood in mansions and on estates, he did not have the social ease of other young men his age and class. Desperately eager to please his parents, he had exhausted himself in trying to scrub sin from his soul. Much like his father, Junior couldn't make decisions lightly and fretted over his choice of a college. Set to go to Yale, he passed its preliminary entrance exam and had even selected a room when reports reached him from one minister that a fast set dominated the Yale social scene. Others might have found this decidedly in Yale's favor, but Junior decided to look elsewhere and finally selected Brown because three close friends had chosen to attend it. As he told Dr. William Rainey Harper, whom he consulted, in a tone of excruciating humility about the choice of schools, "Being naturally somewhat retiring, I beg you to pardon personal references. I do not make friends readily, and some of those interested in my welfare fear if I go to Yale in a class wholly strange to me, I will be lost in the crowd, so to speak, and remain much by myself instead of getting the social contact I so greatly need." Junior tended to discuss himself clinically as if he were a laboratory specimen wriggling under glass, his parents, especially his mother, having taught him to probe his behavior with such antiseptic detachment. Junior entered Brown in September 1893, just as the industrial slump worsened and his college years unfolded against a turbulent backdrop of radical rhetoric and labor unrest, much of it directed against his father. Founded in the 18th century, Brown was the oldest and best-endowed Baptist college, and its president, E. Benjamin Andrews, was a Baptist clergyman cum political economist. In those days, college presidents were often ordained ministers who had a profound impact on the student body in classroom and chapel alike. During the Civil War, Andrews had lost an eye in the Petersburg siege, and his glass eye endowed him with a visionary gaze. Junior admired his spiritual zeal and keen intelligence and was especially struck one day when Andrews told him, "Rockefeller, never be afraid to stand up for a position when you know you are right." 6 months before Junior arrived at Brown, Andrews had composed a flattering letter to Henry Demarest Lloyd about wealth against commonwealth. "It is decidedly in my line," he assured him, "although you are more radical than I am at some points." Not averse to trusts, Andrews wanted to regulate them for the public good and distribute their benefits more equitably. When Junior took a course with him in practical ethics, Andrews gave him a finer appreciation for employer responsibility in big business. In one undergraduate essay, Junior already evinced the proclivity for corporate reform that would mark his adult life. "Who can look about upon the millions of laborers whose life is a treadmill, a continuous round of work to which they are driven by dire necessity, without being fired with a desire to revolutionize their condition by adopting the profit-sharing system?" However idolized by students, Andrews was roundly condemned by many alumni when he supported William Jennings Bryan's presidential bid in 1896 and endorsed free coinage of silver, an episode that cost him his job. Henry Demarest Lloyd spied Rockefeller's fine hand in the ouster, telling a friend, "One of the reasons which actuated the trustees in crowding Andrews out was the statement that as long as he remained, Mr. Rockefeller would never give the university any money." A bashful young Rockefeller, quartered in Slater Hall, was much shorter than his father, but broad-chested and square-shouldered. Both his mother and Grandma Spellman exhorted him to be vigilant against dormitory vice. In his first letter home, he reassured them by saying that he had already attended a prayer meeting, adding, "Grandmother will be interested to know that there are three colored men in the class." He also had begun teaching a Sunday school class at a Baptist church in Providence, and his relieved father wrote him that "the moral and religious tone seem of the best." During his busy freshman year, Junior joined the Glee Club, the Mandolin Club, and a string quartet with some young ladies. As he ventured timidly beyond the self-contained world of his youth, he could not just enjoy spontaneous pleasure, and had to justify it in terms of self-improvement. When he joined a college operetta, he wrote his mother, "Then, too, appearing on the platform before people as I would do and have done in the Glee Club, gives me confidence in myself and helps me to become easy in public, which I always need." Doggedly earnest, tenacious in his studies, Junior was a good enough student to make Phi Beta Kappa, and he especially enjoyed economics and sociology. Unlike his father, however, his self-confidence was a fragile bloom, easily crushed. "If a person scolded me," he said, "I shut up like a clam. I wasn't much of a scholar, but I always tried hard, and I didn't like to be reproached." Everybody noticed his Baptist austerity. He did not drink, smoke, play cards, go to the theater, or even read Sunday papers. True to his temperance pledge, he plied students with crackers and hot chocolate when they came to his room, but he terribly upset Grandma Spellman when he let boys smoke there. Junior's frugality was the stuff of campus legend, and everybody had a favorite anecdote. How he soaked apart 2 2-cent stamps that got stuck together, or how he pressed his own trousers, sewed his own buttons, and mended his own dish towels. Following his father's example, he recorded every expense in his little book, sometimes to snickers from classmates, and even recorded bouquets of flowers bought for dates. Whether putting money in the plate at church or buying a pencil from a beggar, he jotted down everything to the last decimal. He told me that his father allowed him all the money he wanted, said a friend, but insisted on an exact account of every penny. Another classmate recalled, It used to be a great joke, particularly among the girls in Providence, and they used to laugh a good deal about being treated to a soda by John D. Rockefeller, Jr., and having him enter it into his book as he sat at the soda fountain. Despite his shy formality, Jr. was generally popular at Brown, or at least highly respected. Some students were bound to see him as a hopeless prig, and one day as he was crossing the campus, one heckled him, Here comes Johnny Rock, reeking with virtue and without one redeeming vice. For the most part, however, he became more sociable and self-assured, and slowly weaned himself from the airless morality of his upbringing. He was tolerant by nature, telling Grandma Spellman in one letter, One sees all sorts and conditions of men here viewing life, duty, pleasure, and the hereafter so differently. My ideas and opinions change, I find, in many ways. I would stickle less for the letter of the law now, more for the spirit. Haltingly, he forged an identity separate from those of his forebears. He was more ecumenical, more open to the outside world, more considerate of alternate views. As president of his junior class, he got his classmates to desist from drinking alcohol at the class supper, which had traditionally been a drunken debauch. And when his class took its annual stag cruise to Newport, Junior agreed to keep kegs of beer on hand, but tried to avert heavy indulgence. His parents were ecstatic. Dear John, his mother wrote, you have been our pride and comfort from the day of your birth, but at no time have we been more grateful for such a son as at the present moment. Tears of joy filled dear father's eyes when your letter was read, and he wants me to tell you how proud and happy it made him. At Brown, Junior learned to savor such illicit pleasures as theater and dancing. Small triumphs for a Baptist boy bred with such unrelenting morality. After his sophomore year, he took a bicycle trip through England with Everett Colby, a classmate whose father was a railroad builder. John D. had invested in his ventures. In London, Junior saw his first plays, The Two Gentlemen of Verona, Charlie's Aunt, and A Midsummer Night's Dream. As if admitting to a furtive visit to a brothel, he told his mother, I shouldn't have done it at home on account of the example, but thought it not harmful in London, where I knew no one and had an opportunity of seeing several of Shakespeare's plays. Junior made it through his freshman year without dancing, then succumbed to this vice sophomore year by dancing all evening at a party thrown at the home of a university trustee. To practice for the event, he whirled his friend Lefferts de Shiel around his dormitory room. The whole evening, as he danced with a Miss Foster, he feared that he would crash to the floor. Holding on for dear life, he had the distinct impression that Miss Foster was propping him up. That evening, he met the vivacious Abby Aldrich, daughter of Rhode Island Senator Nelson Aldrich, but could not muster the courage to dance with her. The love of dancing lasted, and by the time he graduated, Junior indulged this sinful passion two or three times a week. Seti Rockefeller never entirely relaxed her militance about this pastime. During his senior year, Junior wanted to repay his classmates for their kindness to him and asked his parents to host a dance in Providence. Striking a compromise, John and Seti agreed to have a musical evening of Mendelssohn, Bach, Chopin, and Liszt, followed by informal dancing. When they mailed out the invitations, the infernal word dancing appeared in small, almost apologetic lettering in the lower left-hand corner of the card. Yet when the evening arrived, Seti developed a headache and took refuge in her hotel room. As a result, Senior, resplendent in tails and white gloves, stood alone on the receiving line, cordially greeting 300 guests. Seti's behavior on this and other occasions supports the thesis that she retreated to her bed as an escape from threatening realities. Before Brown, Junior had known little about sports. The Rockefellers were more interested in exercise, which stressed health, than in sports, which stressed pleasure. When he became a manager of the football team his senior year, Junior endured endless ribbing when he referred to the center as the middle. He was so much his thrifty father's son that when one husky lineman asked for new shoestrings, Jr. retorted, "What did you do with the pair I gave you last week?" Because of his son's position, Sr., who had never been to a football game, attended one in New York between Brown and the Carlisle Indians. He started out in the stands, calmly surveying the spectacle, then grew so excited that he rushed down to the field in his tall silk hat and began to race up and down the sidelines with the coaches. The captain of the team assigned a lineman to explain the fine points of the game to him, and with his exceptional mind for tactical maneuvers, John D. Rockefeller gave the impression that he had mastered the game with all its subtleties within 5 minutes. Junior needed somebody who would release him from the suffocating prudery of his upbringing, and that liberating figure was Abby Aldrich. She was a confident girl who did not need his money and was not awed by his name. Something about the socially maladroit Junior appealed to the maternal instincts of this sophisticated young lady with the gracious manners and erect carriage of a senator's daughter. One of 8 children, she had often hosted her father's Washington receptions and had met everyone from General Ambrose Burnside to William McKinley to Custer's widow. Tall, voluptuous, and somewhat matronly in appearance, she was handsome rather than pretty. She liked to wear broad-brimmed, eccentric hats, a symbol of her outgoing personality. She seemed to give Junior the faith in himself that his parents couldn't foster. As he said of their meeting sophomore year, "She treated me as if I had all the savoir-faire in the world, and her confidence did me a lot of good." Through Abby, Junior made a startling discovery that had been artfully concealed from him. Life could be fun. Abby came from old New England stock on her mother's side and was descended from elder William Brewster, a passenger on the Mayflower. Though the son of a mill hand, Senator Aldrich claimed Roger Williams, the founder of Rhode Island Colony, as an ancestor. Tall and virile, with thick mustache and side whiskers, the unflappable Senator Aldrich had escaped from poverty, but he never lost his dread of it. He was elected to the U.S. Senate in 1881 and held that seat for the next 30 years, winding up as chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. A confirmed protectionist and devoted servant of the trusts, he used public office to feather his own nest. Bolstered by a $5 million loan from the American Sugar Refining Company, the so-called Sugar Trust, he invested in 4 Providence street railway companies while also representing the New Haven Railroad. Senator Aldrich turned public service into such a lucrative racket that he amassed $16 million by his death. As if he were a mogul, not a public servant, he built a 99-room chateau at Warwick Neck on Narragansett Bay and sailed a 200-foot yacht, equipped with 8 staterooms and a crew of 27. He bore a host of pejoratives, most notably those conferred by Lincoln Steffens, who referred to him in McClure's magazine as the political boss of the United States, the power behind the throne, the general manager of the U.S. Too entrenched to be ruffled by such journalistic pinpricks, Senator Aldrich stuck by his policy of deny nothing, explain nothing. Abby grew up in a lively atmosphere of balls, parties, and plays. Opposed to religious severity, Aldrich spoiled his children with presents and seldom disciplined them. At the Aldrich Mansion at 110 Benevolent Street in Providence, the senator liked to play bridge or even poker with Abby. In later years, Junior would not join the game but sat quietly with a book, unable to break that taboo. A self-taught aesthete with a highly cultivated taste for books and art, the senator had an excellent library of antique books, frequented auctions for furniture, rugs, and art, and so thoroughly schooled Abby in European museums that she knew their paintings by heart. As a teenager, she dipped into the novels of Dickens, Trollope, Hawthorne, Jane Austen, and George Eliot. Junior's romance with Abby played itself out amid a whirl of college dances, football games, tandem bike rides, and canoe trips, as well as church services on Sundays. When they strolled along, Junior carried graham crackers in his pocket, and Abby freely reached in and helped herself. As Junior said, she was so gay and young and so in love with everything. By the spring of junior year, Junior was a regular visitor at Benevolent Street. One Sunday, he mentioned in passing to the senator his summer plans to cruise the Norwegian fjords with his sister Alta. The senator must have warmed to the idea of Abby marrying young Rockefeller, for a few weeks later he bought tickets for himself, his wife, and two daughters on the same ship, and they dined together during the cruise. Back in Providence in the fall, Junior saw Abby so frequently that people began to speculate when they would marry. But Junior approached the matter with the same soul-searching and nervous energy that he brought to every major decision, and he vacillated through 4 years of tortured introspection. It was perhaps apparent to everybody in Providence except him that he would someday marry Abby. Certainly the size of his projected inheritance made the choice of wife a momentous decision. Junior idealized his father, yet he had to deal with a mounting drumbeat of criticism against him. Abby seemed tailor-made to help him with this predicament, for they were both the children of public pariahs. Junior must have admired her ability to be the loyal daughter of a controversial senator while clinging to her own liberal beliefs. She lived in a way that betrayed neither her father nor herself and thereby pointed a path for Junior. As he approached graduation, Junior still engaged in hero worship of Senior. His glorified image of his father was inextricably bound up with his lowly image of himself. On his son's 21st birthday, Senior sent him $21, along with a tender note. "We are grateful beyond measure for your promise and for the confidence your life inspires in us, not only, but in all your friends and acquaintances, and this is of more value than all earthly possessions." To this, Junior replied, "People talk about sons being better than their fathers, but if I can be half as generous, half as unselfish, half as kindly affectionate to my fellow men as you have been, I shall not feel that my life has been in vain." As Junior contemplated the duties that awaited him after college, the prospect only magnified his sense of inadequacy. Shortly before graduation, he was invited to join the board of the American Baptist Home Mission Society. When he asked his father's advice, Junior made clear that, "My first duty as well as my pleasure after this year would be to help you in whatever capacity or position you might see fit." He never wavered in this decision to subordinate his life to his father's. As graduation neared, Junior grew wistful about his years at Brown and the relaxed camaraderie it had allowed him. He would shortly emerge into the spotlight of public attention, which would burn brightly for the rest of his life. As he thought of following in his father's footsteps, his courage failed him, and he told his mother soon after graduation, "I feel but little confidence in my ability to fill the position which is before me, but I know that I am not afraid to work or do whatever is required of me, and with God's help I will do my best. The future is glowing with possibilities of service for God and man," said he wrote back. "May the Holy Spirit take possession of your entire being and guide you into all truth." By making him view life so loftily, by encouraging him to see himself as a valiant Christian soldier, she might have inadvertently exacerbated his anxieties. This transcendent perspective seemed to allow little room for normal human failure. Junior's father, meanwhile, remained inscrutably silent about Junior's forthcoming role at 26 Broadway, which could only have deepened his dread of the unknown. When John D. Rockefeller Jr. started working on October 1, 1897, he was entering 26 Broadway not long after Senior had left it. He was installed at an oak roll-top desk on the austere and slightly shabby ninth floor, in an office suite dedicated to his father's outside investments and philanthropies. He worked cheek by jowl with Frederick T. Gates, George Rogers, and the telegrapher, Mrs. Tuttle, who had the dubious honor of opening Rockefeller's crank mail. And there was a great deal of it, said Junior. Though he worked in the Standard Oil building, Junior was uninvolved in its management, and he belonged instead to the incipient Rockefeller family office. If his $6,000 annual salary, paid by father, seemed generous, it was a disguised allowance that kept Junior in a state of childlike dependence. Junior turned aside suggestions that he go to law school or treat himself to an around-the-world trip. I felt that I had no time for either, that if I was going to learn to help Father in the care of his affairs, the sooner my apprenticeship under his guidance began, the better. Junior was again living at 4 West 54th Street and had ample opportunity to sound him out, yet the taciturn senior provided no clues about what he expected of his son, leaving him in limbo. Father never said a word to me about what I was to do in the office before I began work there, nor has he ever since. Moreover, he did not say anything on the subject to anyone else in the office, so far as I've ever learned. Apparently, he intended that I should make my own way. Junior never admitted to being bothered by this tight-lipped approach. Like God, Father's ways were mysterious, but it was always assumed benevolent in the end. As a stout believer in self-reliance, Senior probably wanted to test his son's aptitude for business and let him find his own way without coaching. Rockefeller had numerous channels of intelligence, and Junior marveled at his knowledge of everything that went on at 26 Broadway. At a certain point during dinner, Rockefeller would apologize to guests for changing the subject and query Junior about his day's work, displaying seeming omniscience about affairs downtown. Rockefeller's gentle, probing questions were the closest Junior came to a business education from him. Father and son disagreed more than they publicly acknowledged, and Rockefeller was once heard to grumble, "You know, boys go to college and come back knowing everything about business and everything else." At work, Junior had no formal place in the hierarchy and had to guess at his powers. He performed some menial tasks, such as filling inkwells. Never given his father's power of attorney, he began to sign papers for him, unsure whether his father would object. When he did not, Junior took this for a sign of approval and continued the practice. The first major task that Senior assigned his son was a ghoulish one, to supervise the design and transport of a soaring granite obelisk for the family burial plot in Cleveland, a shaft so huge it took up 2 freight cars. The young Brown graduate also picked out wallpaper for the family houses, sold worn-out buckboards and carriages, and managed Rockefeller real estate in Cleveland. One observer called it an anxious and troubled time for Junior, who felt that his performance was wanting, that he was not earning his keep, and that he was unequal to his appointed destiny. If Junior did not feel totally adrift in these years, the credit must go to Frederick T. Gates, who gave him the guidance he sorely missed from his father. Together they toured iron ranges in Minnesota and timberlands in the Pacific Northwest, often playing violins together in their private railroad car. Gates invited Junior to audit business meetings, and he responded with everlasting gratitude. Under Gates's tutelage, Junior began to assume his rightful place in the Rockefeller firmament and joined the University of Chicago board just 3 months after starting work. While still in his 20s, he became a director of U.S. Steel, National City Bank, the Delaware, Lackawanna, and Western Railroad, and, of course, Standard Oil. Bowed by a sense of premature failure, Junior was desperate to succeed at something and decided to try his hand at the stock market. Since his father had professed a Puritan contempt for Wall Street, Junior was surprised to learn that he had played the market for years and traded actively. To teach them the art of investing, Rockefeller allowed Junior and his sister Alta to borrow from him at 6% and invest in equities. During his maiden year at 26 Broadway, Junior made several $1,000s in the market and, like all giddy novices, began to take more risks and place ever larger bets. Meanwhile, a Wall Street operator named David Lamar, later styled the Wolf of Wall Street, began to cultivate George Rogers, Senior's private secretary. In the fall of 1899, Rogers served as the gullible go-between for a scam. Transmitting information from Lamar, Rogers informed Junior that James R. Keene, a celebrated stock trader, had taken a big position in U.S. leather and suggested that Junior join the buying. Led to believe that he was acting in concert with Keene, Junior took a gigantic stake in the stock. Upon learning that George Rogers was meeting secretly with Lamar at lunchtime, he had a queasy intuition of foul play. Junior summoned Lamar to his office, and he arrived with a flushed, agitated air. as Junior recalled. One look at him was enough. I knew I had been sold out. It turned out Keene knew nothing of the affair and that Lamar was liquidating leather stock as fast as Junior bid it up. The unthinkable had happened. The meek Junior had dropped nearly $1 million, equal to more than $17 million today, of father's money in the market. He knew the situation was unforgivable. He had never asked to meet Keene, had done no research, and had thrown away a fortune on a wild tip. One can only guess Junior's emotional turmoil when he broke this astonishing news to his father, a harrowing meeting that was forever seared into his memory. Never shall I forget my shame and humiliation as I went up to report the affair to father. I hadn't the money to meet the loss. There was nothing else to do. Senior listened quietly and conducted a calm but thorough inquiry, investigating every detail of the transaction, all without a syllable of reproach. At the end, he simply said, "All right, I'll take care of it, John." Junior waited for some criticism, some outburst, some paternal homily about future behavior, but nothing further was said. It was a vintage Rockefeller performance. The true lesson lay in what he did not say and what he did not do. Rockefeller sensed that his insecure son had castigated himself so unmercifully that bitter reproaches were superfluous. By showing generosity, he enlisted his son's loyalty forever. The incident must have reinforced Junior's innate conservatism, for the one time he had entered into a rash, immoderate scheme, he had been severely punished. Working for months without a break, Junior began to carry a lot of pent-up tension. To purge this nervous energy, he went after work to the West 55th Street stable, where his father's horses exercised in bad weather, and furiously chopped firewood from 20-foot logs. Over lunch one day with Henry E. Cooper, a former Brown classmate, Junior brooded about his own inadequacy. Startled by the personality change, Cooper followed up with a letter of friendly advice. "You are altogether too grumpy, too morose and gloomy, John. I truly think it would do you good, for instance, to take up smoking an occasional cigarette or something of that sort. I am not joking. Just try being a shade more reckless or careless as to whether or not you reach perfection within 5 years, and see if you don't find more happiness." Pathetically eager to please, Junior noted in his ledger a few days later, "Pack of cigarettes, 10 cents. It was the last time he ever smoked. Trapped on a treadmill of work, duty, and prayer, Junior found it hard to squeeze in time for Abby Aldrich. Sometimes, on weekends, he took the train to Providence after work, dined with her, then grabbed the midnight train back to New York. In Manhattan, Junior often attended dances and parties with Alta, who was also living at home. She developed such an excessive attachment to her brother that she treated Abby as a rival and tried to undermine her. Alta's adamant opposition could only have prolonged Junior's doubts about marrying Abby. Senior saw that his son could not carry his load lightly and begged him to relax more. Seti, however, insistently pushed him forward in his quest for moral perfection. 2 days after he began at 26 Broadway, she prodded him to join the Bible class at the Fifth Avenue Baptist Church, telling him to be mighty in the Scriptures. The most powerful Christians are Bible Christians. Sometimes she made it seem that humanity's salvation hinged upon his personal purity. In an astonishing letter of July 23, 1899, Seti likened her husband to God and Junior to the Christ child. "You can never forget that you are a prince, the son of the King of Kings, and so you can never do what will dishonor your father or be disloyal to the king." Seti's tone is especially revealing amid the rising attacks against Standard Oil. Much like her husband, she had fashioned an alternate reality in which, instead of being a corporate villain, he was converted into an American saint. There were no shades of gray permitted in the Rockefeller household. Exhausted by work and beset by self-doubt, Junior pondered whether to marry Abby Aldrich and prayed daily for divine guidance for 4 years. "I always had a dread of marrying someone and finding out later that I loved someone else more. I knew a great many girls, and I had so little confidence in my own judgment. Things looked promising in April 1900 when Junior joined Senator Aldrich and Abbey on a journey to Cuba aboard President McKinley's yacht, the Dolphin, a senatorial trip to study conditions there following the Spanish-American War. Still, Junior hesitated, unable to suppress his doubts. In the stuffy Rockefeller household, both parents and son balked at bringing up the subject. Finally, his sister Edith, acting as intermediary, told her brother that their parents were worried about him and felt that they were being kept in the dark, at last opening the forbidden subject to discussion. In February 1901, Junior and Abby submitted to a 6-month separation as a trial of their affections. After the time had expired, Junior was strolling by the lake at Forest Hill with Setti when he summoned up the strength to ask her opinion of Abby Aldrich. Her hearty, laughing response was categorical. "Of course you love Miss Aldrich. Why don't you go at once and tell her so?" Junior needed that maternal validation, that direct push. Soon afterward, at West 54th Street, he heard God's voice in the wee hours, blessing his choice of Abby. After many years of doubt and uncertainty, great longing and hope, there came a supreme peace of calm. Before dawn, he dashed off a letter to Abby, asking if he could visit her. Stopping off to see Senator Aldrich on his yacht in Newport, he asked for his daughter's hand and began to lay out his salary and financial prospects. Doubtless with some amusement, the senator brushed aside all money concerns and delivered the predictable bromide, "I am only interested in what will make my daughter happy." An ecstatic Junior went to the Aldrich summer estate at Narragansett Bay and proposed to Abby by moonlight. "I can't believe that it is really true that all this sacred joy is mine. For so long, long a time, it has been the one thing in life above all others that I have yearned for," Junior wrote his mother. Abby then had 6 suitors, leading Junior to observe retrospectively, "I kept wondering why she ever consented to marry a man like me." But she never regretted her decision. As she wrote to a cousin many years later, "Don't you think him quite the dearest man that ever was?" When the engagement was announced in August 1901, the press had a field day. "Croesus captured," trumpeted one paper. Many articles commented upon the odd match of the fun-loving Aldriches and the doer Rockefellers. As one paper said, "Young Mr. Rockefeller is a Sunday school teacher and doesn't believe in cards, dancing, or décolleté gowns. And Miss Abby has never been able to make up her mind that she can renounce these things." Although Senator Aldrich and Senior came in for their usual rough treatment, Abby and Junior were applauded for their more progressive views. The extravagant wedding at Warwick on October 9, 1901, reflected the cosmopolitan style of Senator Aldrich, who made scant concessions to his Baptist in-laws. By chartered steamer and private railway car, he transported a huge portion of the American plutocracy to the affair, which glittered with Goulds and Whitneys, McCormicks and Havemeyers. The marriage was a satirical bonanza for muckrakers. As David Graham Phillips darkly interpreted the union, "The chief exploiter of the American people is closely allied by marriage with the chief schemer in the service of their exploiters." The affair began with a small private wedding, limited to 35 guests and presided over by the Reverend J.G. Colby, who had married John and Setti 37 years before. Then 1,000 people trooped gaily through a vast reception in the ballroom. Senator Aldrich refused to truckle to the temperance views of his in-laws, and personally selected an array of vintage wines. This was too much for Setti, who developed chills, asthma, and diarrhea the night before the wedding, and took to her bed for spiritual safety, skipping the ceremony the next day. An exact replica of her performance at Junior's senior year dance at Brown. Once the stylish guests had fled, Junior and Abby spent a glorious month in seclusion at the house Senior had purchased in the Pocantico Hills of Westchester. For the first months of married life, the newlyweds lived with John and Setti at 4 West 54th Street, then crossed the street to a rented four-story mansion at number 13. Junior tried, with some trepidation, to initiate his free-spirited wife into the cramped clerical ways of the Rockefellers, suggesting she might like to keep a weekly expense account. "I won't," Abby said bluntly, ending the matter forever. To a family muzzled by taboos, she brought a refreshing candor. When a visitor asked her, "Whatever are you going to do with this great big empty house, Abby?" she looked at him in astonishment. "Why, we shall fill it up with children." Chapter 20. The Standard Oil Crowd. Outwardly, at least, Frederick T. Gates was the antithesis of his famous patron, as florid and melodramatic as Rockefeller was, cool and withdrawn, with close-set eyes that looked slightly crossed, head tilted to one side with a sardonic smile. The philanthropic chief often looked as if he was skeptically sizing up the world. A tall, well-built man with a restless, energetic air, he could talk with gusto for hours at a stretch, as if delivering a fiery sermon.